Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Okay, so if you have Bibles, could you turn to Joshua 20, verses 1 to 9? And bear with me, because some of the names here are slightly complicated. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Tell the Israelites to designate the cities of refuge, as I instructed you through Moses, so that anyone who kills a person accidentally and unintentionally may flee there and find protection from the avenger of blood. When they flee to one of these cities, they are to stand in the entrance of the city gate and state their case before the elders of that city. Then the elders are to admit the fugitive into their city and provide a place to live among them. If the avenger of blood comes in pursuit, the elders must not surrender the fugitive, because the fugitive killed their neighbor unintentionally and without malice aforethought. They are to stay in that city until they have stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who is serving at that time. Then they may go back to their own home in the town from which they fled." So they set apart Kadesh in Galilee, in the hill country of Naphtali, Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. East of the Jordan, on the other side from Jericho, they designated Beza in the wilderness on the plateau in the tribe of Reuben, Ramoth in Gilead in the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan in the tribe of Manasseh. Any of the Israelites or any foreigner residing among them who killed someone accidentally could flee to these designated cities and not be killed by the avenger of blood prior to standing trial before the assembly. Could you join me in welcoming Liam to the stage?
Thank you. Good morning. How are you all doing? That was a slightly hairy journey over from the south. I was kind of glad I made it, but also sort of I would have been curious to know what Vicky would have made if I'd just been like, no, I can't be there. You've got to preach on that. So we are in the series on Joshua. We've reached chapter 20, which contains instructions for what to do if you accidentally kill someone, which I know many of you have been waiting for this sermon. I'm sorry it's taken us so long to get round to it. Actually, as a pastor, one of the questions I'm most frequently asked at Christchurch is, what should I do? Where should I go? I mean, that's mainly people from the East Service, to be frank, what are we going to do with this? Okay, so Joshua 20, a bit of background. Joshua has led the people into the promised land, and now they are making a significant transition from having been nomadic people to city-dwelling people. And God gives them instructions for how they are to build the cities, what kind of cities they are to build. And as part of this, he tells them to build cities of refuge. Now, in the ancient world, particularly in societies where there wasn't an established police force or justice system, it would be very easy for people to take matters into their own hands. And so if someone lost a family member, if they were killed, then often people would resort to blood vengeance. And that could quickly spiral into a whole sort of just mess of vengeance as one person takes revenge against another family who then take revenge back again. And, you know, it's the kind of stuff of Romeo and Juliet, The Godfather, those kind of things. And the people who would seek vengeance were known in this passage as the avenger of the blood. And God so wants to bring justice in his society that he sets these rules for building cities where people can find safety rather than experiencing so-called justice at the hands of the avengers of blood. And while it might not seem immediately obvious what on earth we're going to do with this passage or how it can relate to our context, I would put it to you that this passage tells us two important things about the character of God and one hint as to the kind of church we should build if we want to be a blessing to the city. The first thing this passage tells us about the character of God is that he is a God of love. If you read the details for how the cities are to be built, both in this passage, also in Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 19, and if you are so inclined, in the rabbis, the sort of ancient Jewish theologians, you'll find all sorts of details for how these cities were meant to be. Let's have the map up. There were 48 cities that they built when they came into the land, 6 of which were designated as cities of refuge. You can see they're fairly evenly spaced out, 3 on the left, or the west, 3 on the east of the river, north, central, and south. And you can see they're pretty much equidistant. The idea being that wherever you were in the land, God wanted you to have equal access to safety, to mercy, if you needed it. The roads between the cities, the rabbis tell us, were 42 ells wide. That is 36 and a half meters, which is double the width, the regulation width of a road in Israel. And again, the idea seems to be that God wanted these roads to be so wide that nothing would get in the way of someone who was running to mercy. These roads were serviced every spring after the bad weather of winter, and bridges were put over the ravines so that if you were traveling, you had to get across a ravine. Usually it would be a long, arduous thing as you'd have to sort of go down slowly and come back up carefully. They put bridges, again, wide bridges, so that anyone who was fleeing for mercy, fleeing for safety with someone hot on the heels, they could quickly and easily get to the city with no obstructions. There were signs at every crossroads. And the signs, there would often be signs directing people where to go, where to find the cities. But there were particular signs that bore this Hebrew word miklat, which means refuge. And these signs would be far bigger than any of the other signs. Absolutely huge, big, bold letters. And the idea is if you are running at top speed, then you don't have time to stop and go, you want to see this thing so that you immediately know mercy is that way. Nothing will slow you down. When you got to the city, you would find that they had painstaking details about the security of the city. The doors were always open, 24/7. They were unlocked, so you wouldn't get there banging on the door, someone coming to hunt you down and have to wait for someone to get out of bed. The doors were always open so that anyone could find mercy. But security was tight. And no weapons were allowed into the city so that nobody could turn up on the pretense of seeking refuge and actually be there to carry out blood vengeance. What's more, they stocked the city with a huge supply of food and clothing so that anyone who found safety and refuge there could last as long as they needed to in the safety of the city. Now, the first thing that these details tell me is that God cares about people. I mean, that is a lot of detail for the cities. God cares about people. He is a God of love. Now, of course, God cares about the life that has been lost through the violence, through the manslaughter. But I think it's striking that God's value of life also extends to the perpetrator. God's view of the sanctity of life is so pure, so precious, that he cares about the one who is fleeing as well as the one who has lost their lives. And he goes to extreme lengths to make sure that mercy is available to everyone. God is a merciful God who loves people despite our flaws and extends grace and mercy to us. Now, when people approach the Bible, the Old Testament in particular, I don't think people often come with that assumption. Very often you hear people say, well, there's a difference between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. The Old Testament is all about vengeance and blood and stuff like that. And the New Testament, he's a God of love. He's the kind of hippie God that we all like. Actually, the Bible writers don't see any kind of distinction like that. The New Testament writers don't talk about there being two gods. The whole Bible, beginning to end, is the story of one God who is best described as love. The author, Preston Sprinkle, who is a brilliant writer with an unfortunate name that sounds like an ice cream topping, he, in his book, Charis, which is wonderful, a brilliant book on grace, particularly in the Old Testament, he says the Old Testament is a kaleidoscope of grace. I love that definition, that description. The Old Testament is a kaleidoscope of grace. And when you hold stories, even stories like this, ones that you're like, why are we even preaching on that? That's just a bit weird. And when we hold them up to our eyes, it's like we see bits of colors, bits of shining glory that come together to show us the technicolor, wonderful, beautiful grace and mercy of God. God cares about people. That's why he goes to such extreme lengths to make sure that anyone at any time, at the moment of their deepest need, can find refuge, can find mercy. The widest roads, the clearest signs, the wide open doors never shut. God seems intent that nothing will get in the way of people making their way to him when they need it most. Actually, if you look at similar setups in other nations of the ancient world, you will find there is nothing even remotely close to this in any of the other nations. I mean, various nations had ways that they would care for their own, but no one had anything quite as detailed as this. The idea of the cities of refuge was unique in the ancient world. And the most unique aspect of the system is in verse 9. It says this: any of the Israelites or any foreigner residing among them who killed someone accidentally could flee to these designated cities. That is an unparalleled idea in the ancient world, because some nations and some gods would have rules that sort of cared for their own. No other nation, no other god had rules that meant that anyone, no matter what your background, your nationality, could find refuge and safety. That is unique in the God of the Bible. There are no limits to the love of God. No one lies outside the reach of his grace. I don't know what you make of God today. It may well be that some of you maybe are struggling with the idea of God at all, but you tend to think, well, if there is a God, surely he's not interested in me. Surely he wouldn't care about my life. There are 7 billion other people he could do without me. God is a God of love. And God cares about everyone such that he puts in this annoyingly detailed system to make sure that his mercy is available to anyone who needs it. You may well think, if you knew what I had done, if you knew what I was running from, you wouldn't think that God loves me. God wouldn't love me. He couldn't love me. I want to tell you, first up, really simple. God is a God of love, and he loves you today. Whether you are running to him or away from him, God wants to extend his mercy to you. In the New Testament, Paul writes this to the Ephesians. He says, I pray that you may have power together with all the Lord's holy people to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. That's my prayer for you this morning. If you don't yet know God, I want you to know the love of Christ. You can know that today. The first thing we see in this rather bizarre passage is that God is a God of love. You with me? The second thing we see is this. God is a God of justice. Think about why the cities were set up in the first place. They were set up for those who had committed accidental manslaughter to run to so that they would find safety. And the idea here is not that they avoid justice by hanging out in this sort of safe haven. Rather, they have safety and security until justice can be done properly, fairly, not by an angry, vindictive accuser of the blood, avenger of the blood. The whole reason for these cities is so that God can uphold justice. Now, if we don't understand the way that justice works in this passage, it's going to take a little bit of hard work, so a bit of a health warning for you. The next 7 or 8 minutes may require a bit more brain power than I would usually demand of you at this time in the morning, but stay with me, because we need to get inside the mindset of an early Israelite in order to understand quite how this slightly odd, archaic system works. So bear with me, and if you find it difficult, Andy, for example, there's a joke and a video clip later, so you'll be okay. Verse 6 says this. When people flee to the city, they are to stay in that city until they have stood trial before the assembly. Now, in the Old Testament, human life was valued so highly that the loss of life wasn't something that could simply be ignored or swept under the carpet. What kind of just God would just sweep that under the carpet? The loss of life had to be dealt with. And the death would have been a huge loss, obviously, for the mourning family, and something had to be done about it. And the way they thought about it was in terms of debt. When a life had been lost, there was a debt that needed to be paid. And human life was so precious, not only in Israel, actually in many of the surrounding nations, that the debt required a life for a life. So the way it works is this. If you were to accidentally, or if you were to kill your neighbor, and then you were to run to the city, you would have safety for a while, until you could stand trial and have a proper trial. And if during that trial it was found that you actually had willfully, deliberately murdered your neighbor, justice would have to be done, a life for a life. And so you would actually be sent out of the city. You would be given over to the accuser, the avenger of the blood, so that justice could be done, a life for a life. That's the way the system worked. However, if you fled to the city and you stood trial and it was found that you were not guilty of murder but manslaughter, then because God is a God of love and mercy, he doesn't want you to have to pay that debt, to lose your life. Something needs to be done about it, but you shouldn't have to pay the debt. So the question is, how does the debt get dealt with? And verse 6 is this. The people who flee to the cities are to stay in that city until they have stood trial before the assembly and until the death of the high priest who is serving at that time. Then they may go back to their own home in the town from which they fled. Now, that is a weird stipulation. What on earth does the death of the high priest have to do with anything at all? Well, the rabbis, the early Jewish theologians, they wrestled with this question. They came to different views. I'll explain why the difference in a moment. But I think the majority view is this. They felt that the death of the high priest paid the debt that was owed, a life for a life. Now, that seems like a baffling idea to us, right? It doesn't fit with our understanding of justice and the way that we think the world works. But actually, it would have been a perfectly understandable idea to these people because they had this system that was full of concepts like sacrifice and substitution. So if you know anything of the Old Testament, you know that if people committed wrong, they believed there was a way to deal with that. They would go to the priest. They would take a pure, blameless, spotless animal. And the animal would be sacrificed. And the idea that was going on there was that this pure animal takes my impurity. It takes my debt. And when the animal dies, the debt is paid and I go free. An odd idea to us, but something they were very familiar with. And the rabbis wrestling with this think, why did God say that bit about the high priest dying? What's the significance there? And they reasoned that actually the high priest, as the representative of the whole sort of temple system, was considered pure and holy and blameless. And so what happened is that at his death, it was like he took upon himself the blame, the debt, a life for a life, so that the people in the city could go free. This was their reasoning. However, as I said, not all the rabbis held this view. And some people struggled with this view. And the reason is because there is actually a fundamental problem with this view. And the problem is this. No priest was sinless. No priest was pure. No priest was holy. And the reason we know that is because before a priest would offer a sacrifice for you, what would they do? They would offer a sacrifice for themselves because they had to deal with their own impurity. And so some of the rabbis say that can't be why this thing works. That can't be the explanation because no high priest is pure enough to stand in the place of another. And that kind of riddle is like the thorn in the side of the whole legal and sacrificial system for thousands of years. People just can't figure it out until the New Testament. And the book of Hebrews in particular, which gives just the most masterful answer. We're going to go through it in detail. Stick with me. Because I think if you get this, you will get the whole Old Testament. I know that's a big claim. I think you will. Hebrews says this. The high priest, the sacrificial system, all these things are merely a copy and a shadow of God's true plan. They are, chapter 9, an illustration for the present time. The gifts and the sacrifices being offered were not actually able to clear the conscience of the worshipper. They couldn't actually do what they promised to do. They were like symbolic ceremonial actions, rituals, external regulations, he says, applying until the time of the new order. The system was flawed. It couldn't deliver on what it promised. And that's the point. The power of the system is that it points to something else. It gets our hearts longing for something that can deliver the true freedom that the system promised but couldn't pull off. What did it point to? Hebrews 2. Jesus was made like his brothers, us, in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Jesus, God himself, took on flesh and became like us, so that he could become the great high priest that we have longed for. And he was made like us in every way, Hebrews says. Every way except one, Hebrews 4. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. And here's the masterstroke. Because that flaw, that fundamental problem with the whole system that makes it just a nice idea but not workable, it's rooted out in Jesus. Because he alone is the only man who has ever lived who has no debt of his own that needs to be paid. Hebrews 7. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. Why? He had no sin of his own to sacrifice for. He sacrificed for their sins once and for all when he offered himself. Jesus was the only high priest who has ever lived who could truly take the place of another. Jesus' death on the cross is the whole thing that the whole Old Testament system pointed to. It is the only reason why Joshua 20 is of any value in our Bible at all. It's the only reason it can work, because it's the death of this high priest that can bring us freedom, our debt paid once and for all. At the cross, we see the love and justice of God coming together in a beautiful and unexpected way. Because God cannot be a just God if he just sweeps debt, sin, brokenness under the carpet. He has to deal with it. But he recognizes the debt is too big, too awful for any of us to pay, and he loves us so much that he steps in and he pays the debt at the cross. Jesus took all the brokenness of the world upon himself. And this is what Christians call the gospel, the good news. That's what the word gospel means. We have a high priest whose death sets us free. But one more thing, and then we'll lighten up a bit. One more thing. Actually, there is a big problem with this text that not even the gospel, not even the cross can deal with. That's quite a big claim. There's something here that not even the cross can deal with. And the issue is this. In Joshua 20, if you were living in the city, and then the high priest died, you could go free. You could go back to your hometown, free, clean, done deal. However, what would happen the next day? Someone would do it again. They would run to the city, they would come in, and that previous high priest's death couldn't do anything for you. It would have no value to you at all. You would have to wait until the next high priest died. That's the way the system worked. So follow the logic through for a moment, and you might say to me, people have said this to me, it's a nice idea, the idea that Jesus could stand in the place of others, but follow the logic through. Surely his death could only have an effect for people who lived up to the point of the cross. Surely Jesus can't actually have any relevance to us today, 2,000 years on. Here's the answer. Hebrews 7. There have been many priests since death prevented them from continuing in office, but because Jesus lives forever, he has a permanent priesthood. Therefore, he is able to save completely those who come to God through him, because he always lives to intercede for them. If it was just because of the cross, if we only had the cross, we would have no good news. There would have been good news 2,000 years ago, no good news today. This is so complex, you could not make it up. The writer of the Hebrews says, because Jesus alone has died in our place and then has risen again from the dead, his priesthood doesn't end. And so any sacrifice he made, it doesn't have a time limit on it. It doesn't have a best before date. He always lives to intercede for us. His cross, his death, his resurrection means that his sacrifice is big enough for anyone at any time, at any point in history. He is unique because of the death and the resurrection of Jesus. How can we experience the mercy of God? It's because of the death and resurrection of Jesus. There is one unique person who served as the high priest, who stood in our place, who took our debt upon himself, and then rose again from the dead to say, it's done, it's finished, and you can return free, blameless. No longer will these things hang over your head. And by rising again from the dead, his sacrifice is fitting for all people at all time. John puts it like this: God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. Now, if you are exploring Christianity today, I imagine you have many questions. I imagine I've also just given you a ton of extra questions. I'm sorry about that. And I'm sorry if I've made that slightly more complex than it may be needed to be. I wanted you to get to grips with this rather difficult, baffling text in Joshua 20 and pretty much tell you the whole of Hebrews in one go as well. But if I can put it simply like this, the good news is that relationship is available, that the doors of God's city, the arms of our God, are open wide, and anyone can find mercy in him. He loves you. Whether you are running from him or towards him right now, whether you think he could ever love you or not, he loves you, and he has shown that by taking your debt upon himself and rising again from the dead, so he always lives to intercede for you. And if you want to know this God today, I would love to talk to you at the end of the service. One of the bonuses of this service is I don't have to jet off anywhere else. I can sit here and talk to you and answer your questions and pray with you if you'd like. And there'll be members of the prayer teams as well, and they would love to talk with you, pray with you if that would help. You may want to ask a friend who you've come with, tell me what difference has the death and resurrection of Jesus made in your life? How have you experienced mercy? It should be a question that they would love to answer. God is a God of love, and he is a God of justice. But the third thing, the final thing this passage shows us, is it gives us a hint about the kind of church that we should be seeking to build if we are to be a blessing to our city. If Joshua 20 tells us that God is a God of love and a God of justice, then it follows that as a community, we should reflect those values. We should be a place that reflects love and justice to our city. We should be a people of good news. And like the cities of refuge, we should be working hard to make sure that there are no obstacles in the way that stop people encountering the love and mercy of Jesus. So here's a question for you, and it's a question I ask myself, and it's a difficult question. If you consider yourself a follower of Jesus, does the way in which you live put obstacles in the way of people finding Jesus? Or are you like the wide road, the big bold sign, the open door, the bridge across the ravine? Does your life act as a signpost that helps people know the way to find mercy in the person of Jesus? The church should be the ultimate place of refuge. It should be a place where anyone and everyone can experience the love and mercy of God and find safety, security, grace, mercy, and restoration. And our lives should be like that sign with that Hebrew word, that miklat. Our lives should be like signposts written big and bold so that anyone, whatever speed they're running, wherever they're running to, see us and see this offer. Refuge, mercy, hope, love, acceptance, good news, good news, good news. Does your life act like that? Is your life a signpost to mercy? I think it's a sad fact that many people look at the church and look at the lives of Christians, and on the basis of what they see, they think, I'm not interested in exploring relationship with this God. I know that's been my experience in the past. I've looked at people when I was doubting, when I was questioning. I looked at people's lives and I thought, if that's what a Christian looks like, I'm not interested. I'm not talking about facial features, although, you know, with some of you. But I would look at people's lives and I'd think, the hypocrisy I see there, like the attitude of exclusivism, the fact that they're more banging on about the things they're against rather than the things they're for, it's just a turnoff. It's not pleasant. It's not nice. And many people see the church as a bad news thing, not a good news thing. The church is often accused of speaking as if it has a holier-than-thou attitude. That shouldn't be the case at all. If you've experienced that, I am so sorry. The church should be a good news thing for you. The church should be like the city of refuge, full of people who just are deeply aware of their need for mercy, their need for a savior, a great high priest. People who've experienced and found that mercy in God and who freely, generously make that mercy available to anyone who asks. The church should not have a holier-than-thou attitude. We should have a, I'm just as much as in need of mercy as thou attitude. That's not going to catch on, but we should be a good news people. Some of you will know Chris Oldfield. He's at the South Service. He preaches here from time to time. Great guy. I remember the first time I ever hung out with him. We talked briefly on a Sunday, but we never really got to know each other. And so we went out for a drink. We were sitting in the South Bank Centre and just talking a bit about just our friends, our backgrounds, all that sort of stuff. And I mentioned someone that he knew, a girl that he knew somehow, a mutual friend. And he went, oh, she is good news. I thought that's a really weird thing to say about someone. Like, does anyone say that? That's weird. I would say they're a good person, a good friend, a good mate, a good laugh, something like that. But I wouldn't really describe a person as news, right? That's just not the way my vocabulary works. Who is this weird guy? But he kept on doing it all through the conversation. I'd be like, oh, I think you know my mate Matt. Oh, Matt, he is good news. I think you know my mate Jen. Yeah, Jen, she is good news. I think you know Andy Tilsley. He'd be like, yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's a weird thing to say about anyone. The good news. Good mate, good laugh, good person, good dancer, good kisser, whatever. But not good news. That's just an odd thing to say about someone. As I went home that night, I thought about it. This was a few years ago. It has stuck with me. I can't shake it. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, that's actually a beautiful thing to say about someone, that they are good news. Because any other thing that you say, good person, good friend, good mate, good laugh, whatever, means that they are good at doing something. To call someone good news is an incredible compliment because it says that their life is like the embodiment of a message. They're like walking, talking, living, breathing demonstrations of good news. What's that word, good news? Gospel. To call someone good news means that you are in their presence and you just get a whiff of the gospel. You are in their presence and you can't help but think of the high priest who died and rose again. Just by being around them communicates a message. I want that to be said of me. I want that to be said of us as a church. I don't want people to go Christchurch London and those people who are moaning a bit, those people who think they're better than everyone. I want people to go Christchurch London. They're good news people. Jesus says this. This has been the plague of my last few weeks, this verse. I've just been thinking about it. It's so challenging. Jesus says in Luke 6, a good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. I've just been wrestling with that over the last couple of weeks as I've spotted some things coming out that I didn't think I had in me, I didn't want to have in me. Jesus says the interior life matters because there comes a point, whether it's a point of pressure or whatever, where something bubbles up and overflows. And if we want to be good news people, if we want good news, mercy, love, joy, acceptance to come out, what do we need in the heart? We need good news, mercy, love, joy, acceptance. And if in our hearts, instead, there is prejudice, arrogance, a superior attitude, what do you think is going to come out? If we are to be good news, we need to be storing up good news in here. So challenging, as I've just been thinking the last few weeks about corrosive thoughts that are in my heart that I need to deal with. The good news is that we have a God who can change hearts. He wants to fill us with his good news so that good news flows forth. If we are to be a church that genuinely serves our city, like a walking, talking signpost that goes, Miklad, mercy, refuge, hope, joy, acceptance, love, grace, all available in him, we need to be filled with good news. If I can change the metaphor for a little bit, this is a guy called Bill. Bill Sorda. I'm modeling my beard on him and... But not my passion for ships, that I find a bit weird. He is a historical consultant, and he has a particular passion for ocean liners. And this guy, Bill, did a lot of work on artifacts that were recovered from the Titanic. He was actually a consultant on James Cameron's film. Don't hold that against him. And he has been involved in plenty of documentaries talking about his experience of working with artifacts on the Titanic. I want to show you just an 80-second clip where he describes an experience he has as he brought these things out of the depths of the ocean and encountered them in the lab. I think it's powerful. I think it's emotional. Let's roll the clip.
One thing I'll remember about Titanic artifacts of the day I die is when the Saffeld perfume vials came up. When you recover stuff from the Titanic, it's wet, it's rusty, and it's rotten. And the smell that comes off it is perfectly alien, perfectly fetid. You know it's a kind of death you have never experienced. And so the lab is kind of unpleasant. And then all of a sudden somebody opens up this satchel, this leather satchel, and out comes the fragrance of heaven. It's all these flowers and fruity flavors, and it's delicious. It's the most wonderful thing you've ever had. It was just a complete overwhelming experience. It was like all of a sudden the fragrance of heaven, you know, kind of goes through the room. So instead of being surrounded by all of these dead things, for those few minutes, the ship was alive again.
That is a beautiful picture of how the church should be, how I want my life to be. The fragrance of heaven, destroying the smell of death. He describes it like this fetid, damp, rock-filled room suddenly coming alive as the fragrance of heaven wafts through it. This world is often overwhelmingly, frighteningly full of rot, the smell of death, fear. So many people live with fear, with distrust of others. Fear, will I be accepted? Can I find mercy? Can I find acceptance? Can I find wholeness? We are meant to be like the fragrance of heaven. Think of the way he described it. He said, like, for that few moments, it was like this dead world came alive again. It's like this lost world just broke into his lab, changed everything. That's how we're meant to be. That's how we're meant to live. Paul talks about us being the aroma of Christ, leading people to life, the fragrance of heaven. How are you doing at this? How are you being the aroma of Christ, a good news person? How are you doing at being that sign that says Miklat, mercy, refuge, hope, joy, heaven, all available through Christ? Maybe the band can come back up. How are you doing at that? How are you doing at that in your workplace, in your community, in your connect groups here in the service with the people you spend time with and prioritize and value? How are you doing that in the community where you live with the people around who are the least and the lowest who no one else wants to serve? Are you being the fragrance of Christ, that Miklat sign, that mercy sign? Church leader I know tweeted the other day about a friend of his, a brilliant little tweet. He said that she had been called into the office of her manager, and her manager sat her down and said, can you help us change the culture of the office? We want this to be an office built upon good news, where we celebrate good news, and we recognize that you are a good news person. Tell us, how do you do it? That is exactly how it should be. How can we be good news people? Maybe there are some people here today who, just as I read that bit from Luke 6, it just resonated with you and you thought, actually, there are things in my life that are not so good news and I need to deal with them, things in my heart. Maybe attitudes that mean you don't go out of your way to help that person. You think, I could never be in community with that person. The gospel would never work for that person. Maybe there are labels or language that you have applied, maybe internally, maybe externally, that mean that you restrict people, make people feel unwelcome on the outside rather than welcomed in. If so, the good news is God can change our hearts. And my encouragement to you is, painful though it will be, bring that to him. Confess it to him this morning. It may help you to talk to someone you trust. It may well help you to come forward and to pray with a member of the prayer team. If we want to be good news to our city, it starts by being good news in here. Or it may well be that actually you feel like the person you identify with most in that story is the guy running for refuge, running for safety. And you just feel like your world is falling apart around you now, maybe due to circumstances you had control over, maybe ones that you just felt you had no control over. The good news to you is there is a high priest who offers mercy. His arms are wide open. You can know him today. And so if we can pray with you, we want to make that road as wide, the doors as open, the path as clear as possible for you to find mercy in God. We would love to pray with you. We will happily do that at the end. Again, come and speak to a member of the prayer team. But first of all, why don't we stand? We're going to worship. We're going to celebrate what Christ has done for us. And then we'll have an opportunity to pray.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.